From the Sky News Centre at 5. The most wanted fugitive from the Paris terror attacks has been caught alive after being wounded in a Brussels shootout, according to a newspaper report in Belgium. Salah Abdeslam is believed to have been injured during an anti-terror raid in Molenbeek. A number of gunshots have been heard. Our reporter Matt Rhodes is there.
I started to see some white smoke emerging from one of the rooms. I have no confirmation of what it is. I mean, it could be a whole number of things. It could be totally innocent, or it could be tear gas being used to go in, or it could be a fire. I just can't tell you. But that wasn't there a couple of minutes ago that I could see.
A deal aimed at easing the migration crisis has been done between European and Turkish officials. Migrants arriving in Greece who don't qualify for asylum will be sent back to Turkey. For every person returned, a Syrian refugee will be rehomed in the EU. A classical musician's been found guilty of murdering his world-renowned pianist wife. Manchester Crown Court heard John Martin, who's 48 and originally from Norway, attacked Natalia Strachenko on their second wedding anniversary. Four people have been arrested by detectives investigating allegations of fraud in the Police Federation of England and Wales. Accounts held by one of its national committees are the focus of the inquiry. The Chancellor says he'll consult with disability charities to make sure planned benefit changes are right. Downing Street insists the government will push ahead with a £1.3 billion reduction in personal independence payments. Dr. Thomas Shakespeare is a disability campaigner and says people will be hit hard.
They might have to get taxis, they might have to get their neighbour to do the ironing, all disabled people have some degree of extra costs. What they're trying to do is to take out those disabled people who have needs but do not have the greatest need.
In sport, Olympic cycling champion Victoria Pendleton has enjoyed a very creditable debut at the Cheltenham Festival. She finished fifth on board 25-1 shot Pasha de Polder in the Fox Hunter Chase. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
If you love BCFM, you can now get the brand new BCFM app. It's available on Android, iOS and BlackBerry. Visit your app store for more details. Just search BCFM. Data charges may apply. Check with your operator.
BCFM, your local community station. On FM, online and on mobile.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Green Councillor for Windmill Hill, Deborah Joffe. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, this week was George Osborne's sixth budget, and like the rest, it's taken from the poor to give to the rich, this time specifically from the disabled to big business. Is this what government is for? And what about the inevitable crash the former governor of the Bank of England warned us about in his new book? Was anything done to claw back money squirrelled away in tax havens by super-rich Tory donors? We speak to tax justice expert and chartered accountant Richard Murphy. And with hundreds of thousands of untaxed acres, one of the country's biggest and oldest landowners, the tax havened up Tory Duke of Buccleuch, now wants to charge us peasants £10 to walk in the country park. It turns out, though, it could all be illegal. Also, the privacy shield. Have the tech giants like Google and Microsoft been breaching our human rights for decades? Will Eric Schmidt and Bill Gates go to jail for their 9 years of breaking the law? And Libya, do we have troops in there now or not? If so, why, like Yemen, has Parliament not been asked? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's two-week weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius, pretty chilly, and some drizzle. This weekend, though, highs of 7, a mainly cloudy but dry weekend. Next week, that's highs of 11, sunnier at the beginning of the week, but windier towards the end of the week, and wet. Next weekend is 26th and 27th of March, Easter weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, sunshine and showers. So no show for us here on Good Friday in a week's time, but in the run-up to May's local elections, we have two-hour-long politics show hustings. One for the Bristol Mayor elections candidates on Friday the 8th of April, and a fortnight after that, the Police and Crime Commissioner candidates on Friday the 22nd of April. Any interesting questions you'd like us to ask, please email them straight to me at Tony. I shouldn't start my email address with at, really, should I? But anyway, it's Tony at cultureshop.org.uk. Helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Windmill Hill, Deborah Joffe. Hi, Deborah. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you, Tony.
Tell us a bit about yourself. Are you a new councillor from last May's elections?
I am, yes. I was elected last year in Windmill Hill, first Green Councillor for Windmill Hill.
And what about you? What's your background? What brought you to become a councillor?
I used to be a Labour Party member and activist, so I've been helping out in politics for quite a while. And then I got involved in climate change campaigning and couldn't really persuade the Labour Party that it was a serious issue. And finally left the Labour Party in when they were trying to introduce a 90-day terrorism detention law, and joined the Green Party. And then they were looking for women councillors, and I felt it was really important that we improved the gender balance. So I volunteered myself, and here I am.
Well, you say you didn't like the Labour Party's policy on energy, is that right? Because, I mean, if you look now, it looks almost like halcyon days from the last Labour government, where solar power was being pushed far more than it is now. I mean, it's gone completely in the other direction, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I'm talking about the days when the Labour government was in power. And yes, it's shocking what the Tories have done. But I still think Labour's got quite a long way to go on their environmental awareness.
I was going for a walk last weekend up in Gloucestershire, and I came across one of these solar farms, and I mean, I don't know, you could tell me what you think of them. I thought it looked appalling. It was a lovely bit of countryside. I've walked there in the past, and now it must be about 300-400 acres of solar panels just stuck in the middle of the countryside. Is this green, the future for green energy?
Well, they're not pretty, and I'm not an expert on renewable energy. There are a lot of other methods of generating electricity power, but I think the main thing that we're really under investing in is energy efficiency, and there is so much more we can do, particularly in building homes, in improving energy efficiency and reducing and smoothing demand for energy. That's got to be the first priority.
I suppose there are two ends to this question, aren't there? One is the demand and the other supply. Martin, I wonder what you make of all this, because as I remember it, in the last Labour government, there were lots of people, individuals, homeowners, and even some people who were like, I suppose, housing associations, people like that, that started putting lots of solar panels on the houses, which then could be used by the people living in those houses. Now what we're getting is privately owned solar farms out in the middle of nowhere, and the subsidies and the help the government's giving people to put solar panels on their own homes is going down. So actually, it doesn't really, it's no detriment to the environment. I mean, you'll probably pull me up on this, but to put it on your own home or on your roof, it's actually kind of out of the way there. But if you're putting hundreds of acres of these things across the countryside, it's really unsightly. And also, of course, it's not really using farmland for what it was originally there for. That is either rearing animals or growing crops and food for us to eat.
Well, as Daphne's just pointed out, the real issue is energy conservation. That has always been the issue. The technology is quite straightforward, but we just don't apply it. I mean, all new housing in Germany, for example, has to be zero emissions. That's certainly not the case in Britain. And ultimately, that is the solution, is to use less energy, not to think of new ways of generating energy, whether it's solar power or nuclear power. We don't have the real transition we have to make is to a low energy future.
I think we should plunge straight in, actually, to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, because the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, asked a question of the Prime Minister, David Cameron, about just this, about the different, basically, level, not a level playing field between wind power and fracking when it comes to providing planning permission in the countryside.
Jeremy Corbyn! Mr. Speaker, if the government and the Prime Minister are so keen on renewable and clean energy, could he explain why on Monday the House approved new regulations to allow communities a veto on clean energy projects like Shore Wind? I got a question from Angela from Lancaster. She asked the Prime Minister this. If I was you, I'd listen. Will the Prime Minister offer the same right of veto to her community and communities like her across the country of a veto on fracking?
Yes.
But we have a proper planning system for deciding these things. But if he wants to know, if he wants to know what is happening in terms of renewable energy, 99% of the solar panels in this country were installed since I became Prime Minister. That is the green record we have. The United Kingdom now has the second largest ultra-low emission vehicle market anywhere in the European Union. Yeah. We've seen one of the strongest growths in renewable energy. But isn't it remarkable? Five questions in and no welcome for the fall in unemployment. No mention of the 31 million people now in work. No mention of the fact that we've got more women in work, more young people in work, that more people are bringing home a salary, bringing home a wage, and paying less taxes. Not a word from the party that I thought was meant to be the party of Labour. That's the truth. The party of working people, getting people into work, is on this side of the house.
Well, I'm not sure whether you want me to comment on the Prime Minister's fantasy that there's a wonderful economic recovery in progress, or Jeremy Corbyn's question about the veto on fracking.
I think it's the fracking that I care more about, because I know that there are, you know, the fracking companies, Godzilla or whatever they're called, have got their eye on something around here. I mean, particularly the Mendips, they want to drill down there and they want to pour their chemicals into the aquifers and into under the ground. And I'm quite concerned if we're being told that local communities are going to be given a veto on solar and, or actually he's talking about wind power there, isn't he, that well, they won't maybe be on fracking.
Yeah, and I'm sure they won't, and it's outrageous that they won't. I mean, you talked about solar farms not being pretty. I think what fracking is going to do to the environment is far worse than what the solar farms have done, not just aesthetically, although there will be, they won't be pretty either, but in terms of pollution and water consumption, environmentally, it's an appalling way to try and generate energy, which, as we said, we don't actually need.
Do you know when the last earthquake was on the Mendips? I'm not sure.
No.
Martin?
No, I don't know when the last earthquake on the Mendips was either. But of course I agree that it's totally unfair that there should be a veto over wind farms, but no veto over fracking. If there's going to be a level playing field, there should be a level playing field, but there isn't, is there?
Yeah, Martin, what do you make of energy policy? What would you do? Because we've got a question coming up again now in a minute about Hinkley.
Well, if it's about Hinkley, I mean, nuclear power simply isn't economically viable by any stretch of the imagination, which is why it has to be massively subsidised, and why the head of EDF Energy in France has recently resigned, because he can't make the sums add up. I used to work for the New Economics Foundation in the 1990s, and I wrote a paper about energy, nuclear energy, and energy efficiency. I actually circulated a paper by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute in the US, and he basically said that the solution to a lot of our problems is really seriously taking energy efficiency, and that, you know, we could retrofit virtually all of our technology to be very, very efficient, and we don't do it because the will simply isn't there to do it, although the technology is really straightforward. We don't have to come up with some new mechanism for bringing oil from shale rocks or splitting atoms.
Okay, Mr. New Economics Foundation, then where do you save the energy, in the home, or is it through transport cars?
Through everything. You just all your technology should be the design specifications should be minimum use of energy from the get-go.
I mean, if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, many people use public transport.
Indeed.
Now everyone's got a car. I mean, the idea that if you were going to work, you'd get probably several hundred people sharing one engine, driving them either on a train or a bus. Now everyone's got their own, haven't they? And they're kind of forced economically to do that, Deborah.
Well, I suppose they're forced partly by the fact that we've obviously public transport isn't adequate for people's needs or isn't affordable enough. So to some extent, I'd agree with you. I think there are other things that are done. I mean, this country has had an economy that's dependent on the car industry for a long time. So it's been in the interests of some people to promote the car industry and to promote car ownership. And again, we've had this freeze on fuel duty for 6 years, which is completely unhelpful in terms of trying to get people.
Well,
to...
look, I can remember as a probably 3 or 4 year old, little Tony, and his street in South London, as he was growing up, in the early 1960s, literally there were only 3 or 4 cars in the entire street. And then what happened? This guy called Dr. Beeching came along with his axe, and he chopped our railway network to pieces. And since then, it's been really an explosion in car use, where some families now, I mean, they're kind of concreting over the front gardens so that there's enough room for 3 or 4 cars.
Yeah, absolutely, and causing all sorts of drainage problems while they're doing it.
I think we've got to be careful, though, about blaming people with cars for this, because it's actually the system. Somehow, since the 1960s, Martin, it's changed, hasn't it?
It has, and of course, you get path dependence. So when the trams were ripped out in Bristol, you've then got to put them back in again. They should never have been ripped out. But of course, the real solutions are quite radical, but quite straightforward. In Seattle, in the US, for example, all buses are free. Talking about whether making the decision to get in the car and drive downtown, or you can hop on the bus, which is free.
Well,
and of course, you have to subsidise public transport anyway, and if you have to subsidise it, why not go the whole hog and subsidise it to make it free? And in actual fact, you could envision of a socialist society is where lots of things would be free. Education and healthcare, which is probably, more than 50% of the economy, plus transport, loads of stuff for free. And that's the future, if we can get through this horrendous capitalist crisis, which is not over by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, we'll be talking about that in a minute, but I would just, you've sort of raised for me this whole business of fares fair in the 1980s.
Indeed.
In London. London Mayor Ken Livingstone decided he was going to work towards making all London's public transport free. Now, this rattled a few cages of people who, particularly in the oil industry, I'd imagine, who like the idea. But Deborah, I can remember looking at the statistics, and just in the first year of this, where they started reducing fares on the buses and the trains and the tube right across London, so more and more people started using them and investing in it, I mean basically being paid for through the rates, there was something like 2,000 less serious accidents on the roads just in the first year that this happened. This is a kind of almost seems like impossible nowadays, now when we've got public transport which is in private hands with people like First Group. We were discussing here a couple of weeks ago that there are enormous debts in the United States, so most of the money you pay when you pay your bus fare is going to service your debt in America.
Yeah, it's frightening, isn't it? And I think it was under Thatcher that they privatisation and of public transport really kicked off, and where bus services were broken up and forced into private hands. You made some point just before that. I can't remember what I was going to say, but anyway. The whole thing is... Oh, yes, I was going to say the other issue is not just road safety, but a growing issue, of course, is air quality. Growing awareness in Bristol, particularly, of the need for taking action to clean up the air.
Yeah, this whole metro bus, what do you make of that? Because Martin's talking about trams. This is not really a tram, is it? It sort of pretends to be.
It's not a tram, yeah. I'm not an expert on the metro bus. It was all kind of a done deal by the time I was elected. But I have to say, now that it's coming, it's better than nothing. And so you know, we have to go with it and encourage people to use it.
Now, I'm really cynical, and I think that what's happening is that the congestion is being deliberately exacerbated. That actually what they're doing is they really want a congestion charge to make to say to everybody, look, is this terrible, isn't it really awful, and maybe everyone should pay to come in and out. And then of course you can have an economic growth, can't you, with everyone having to pay for something that previously was free.
Well, if that money went into the public sector, I wouldn't be so worried. Obviously, if it's going into the private sector, it'd be more of a concern.
Okay, now let's go to, I did mention it briefly, didn't I? Hinckley C, Prime Minister's questions came up again. And this is a sort of running sore, really, because it doesn't look like it's going to happen. As Martin mentioned, the finance director of EDF Energy resigned a couple of weeks ago. I think it's about time we got Friends of the Earth in to talk about this in a couple of weeks' time, maybe in April or whatever. But let's have a listen to that Prime Minister's question this week.
Alan McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister's energy policy is a complete shambles. It is wholly dependent upon the troubled and eye-wateringly expensive new nuclear plant at Hinckley. There is barely a plan A, let alone a plan B. Is the Prime Minister seeking to build the world's most expensive power station or the world's biggest white elephant?
Well, what we're planning is to continue with a successful energy policy which is seeing cheaper energy and lower carbon at the same time. Now, the whole strength of the Hinckley deal is that there is no payment unless this power station goes ahead and is built efficiently by EDF. And I think that will be good for our energy supplies, because if you want to have energy at low cost and low carbon, you need to have strong nuclear energy at the heart of your system.
Well, I mean, the fact is that the sums don't just add up. I mean, the only reason why EDF are able to contemplate investing in this is because they're state-owned, and the French state has subsidised nuclear industry over decades, and they've got to sell it on to somebody. It's like being addicted to heroin. You know, you've, in order to cut your own costs of buying heroin, you've got to sell it to other people. And even so, it's still massively... It just doesn't add up. And once you really calculate in things like getting rid of the waste, I mean, most people don't realise that a massive chunk of British taxes goes to managing our existing nuclear waste pile. That's where the money goes, not on single mums.
Deborah, people will blame the Greens and the lefties, won't they, if the power goes out and we haven't got enough energy to light our homes and to cook on, all that sort of thing.
Well, I'm not sure why they would blame the Greens, because I don't think the Greens have had a chance to do what needs to be done with their energy policy. We've got an interesting situation at the moment with these applications that are being put in for local diesel generators around the city to try and cope with surge in demand. And it just highlights how we're doing the wrong thing. If we invest in energy efficiency, we're not going to need this extra energy.
So what are these diesel generators? Is the idea that people put them in their backyard?
No, they're bigger than that, and they're sited. I think there's one that I know about particularly that they're planning to site in St Philip's, and it will serve, you know, part of the city.
I mean, isn't it sensible to have things like that if we're being told that the power might run out, if Hinckley doesn't get built, etc., just as a backup?
Well, if you're talking about burning diesel, and we've got increasing information now about the health challenges.
Now, look, I mean, what I'm saying is you've got a choice here. You're saying, well, actually, we will only need to switch these things on if the power is there not enough power to go round.
Yeah, well, and I'm saying the choice is to build. For example, there are not in this city, there is the first council passive houses are being built now. They're quite, it's all very affordable. The figures add up now. And if we're doing that sort of thing, and putting in, which we have got plans to do, district heating systems, we shouldn't need these extra generators, and we shouldn't need nuclear power.
But people will point the finger at you, won't they, if the lights do go out, and they'll say, well, you're saying that they wouldn't just now, but if you're trying to stop the backup system being put in St Philip's, they'll be pointing the finger at you.
Well, they might be. They'll have to contend with the arguments about energy efficiency. I'll point the finger somewhere else.
So you'd rather the lights go out and the power goes out than we've got some kind of backup, even if it is diesel?
I think there's no place for diesel, and I don't think that it's a straight choice between those two options.
Martin?
Well, I'd have to tend to agree. I mean, we've had decades where we haven't taken seriously the whole question of having an integrated energy policy. For example, having a transport policy. policy. The market, which is absolutely rigged, is supposed to decide. Absolutely idiotic. A whole generation has been wasted. No doubt it's going to take a while to turn that round, even if the will was there. And at the moment it isn't. What will happen over Hinkley Point, of course, is that loads of money will be spent on it, our money, and in the end, it won't even come on stream. It's a massive waste of money. But of course, the vested interests are enormous in going down that road. Because, as I said to you before, once you become path dependent, the French are 70% dependent on nuclear energy. It's only because the government intervened. I did a paper about this in the 1990s for New Economics Foundation. Nuclear power has never added up. Never added up. Because the waste is... nobody knows what to do with the waste, and the waste from Hinkley will have to be dealt with by the government, because the private sector, when they tried to privatise the nuclear industry in the 1980s, the Tory government were really keen to privatise the nuclear industry. The City of London was licking its lips with joy at the idea of doing it. Then they looked at the figures and went, no way, Jose, not if we're responsible for the waste. It only becomes viable if the government picks up the waste bill and the private sector picks up the profits. Pretty much what happens with public transport, where first bus are subsidised to provide certain services because they can't make them pay. And in actual fact, an awful lot of other industries, that's also true of. The losses are socialised, profits are privatised. There's no economic case for that at all. And ultimately, of course, this kind of free market messing around that we've done in this country for a generation is going to come full circle and smack us in the face, because we haven't done any of the right things for 30 years. And the idea that the Thatcher revolution was some kind of positive development that went too far. It was always a determined march in the wrong direction, as we're going to find out when the banks collapse, as they probably will in the very near future.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, you've been saying that for a long time, but Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, agree with you. It was pretty shocking, I suppose, surprising. Anyway, Deborah, just tell us a little bit about what you've been, your experience in your first year nearly now at the City Council, and what committees you've been sitting on, and I suppose the other big question is your experience of dealing with the mayor, and when you're voting on things and the mayor can just turn the other way and ignore you.
Yes, it certainly, I mean, not for me, because I've only operated under that system, but I think that's quite a shock for councillors who've been operating since before the mayor or system. It's been very interesting. I've sat on people's scrutiny, which has an enormous brief. It's supposed to scrutinise all of social care and children's services and education, which is pretty hard to scrutinise that amount of information. And I've sat on the police and crime panel for the last year, which has also been very interesting. So, I've learned an awful lot through doing this. Whether I've been able to actually have much influence or not is pretty moot. It's a case of sometimes being able to shape an agenda, but more often than not, you're just trying to keep up with council officers.
The police and crime panel, you've had a bit of a rocky ride, haven't you? With, I suppose you've witnessed this departure of the chief constable finally.
Yeah, and once again, I came in after the chief constable had been suspended. But obviously it was still ongoing, and we had quite a lot of extra meetings on the panel as a result of all the various different stages.
Were you happy with the way it was all handled, do you think?
I think it's obvious that there were a lot of errors made along the way. It's hard to say that anybody in that position would have done any better. And some of the problems were not to do with the police commissioner, and they were not to do with the police and crime panel or the police force themselves. Other problems within, trying to remember what they're called, but the police complaints investigation.
Because, I mean, the weird thing about that was that he wasn't actually, it was misconduct, it wasn't gross misconduct. You can sack somebody for gross misconduct, but not for misconduct, but he was sacked anyway.
Well,
this is the sort of, you know, the kind of, anyone that's been involved in trade unions would be rather irked to think that someone could be sacked for something which actually wasn't a sackable offence.
Yeah, I think what, he wasn't directly sacked, he was asked to resign, and I think that it's slightly different from your average role, being chief constable of the police force. I think you have to behave impeccably and recognise that the significance of what you do.
Okay, well, I would agree with you, but the previous Chief Constable, Colin Port, certainly did not behave impeccably. I mean, he was served with a High Court writ for at his home because of a court case where he'd sent his detectives to another part of the country to do a raid against somebody who was an expert witness against the police.
Okay.
And there were all sorts of... I mean, a lot of people have said about this whole situation was that Sue Mount Stevens, as an independent police and crime commissioner, was brought in to sort of clear out the old guard of old mates that were running the police and to bring in a new broom, and it just proved to be impossible.
Well, I mean, Sue Mount Stevens was elected, albeit by a very low turnout election, but she had to fight an election, so to say she was brought in to do something, I'm not sure.
Well, that was
sure.
part of her platform,
right, okay,
you know, to sort of be a completely new broom in the police.
Yeah, and I have to say I've supported quite a lot of things that she's done at a strategic level. She's put the vulnerability of the victim at the heart of policing, and that's helped transfer resources that a lot of people who would never see much police resource have now getting a much fairer share as a result.
But we even had the case of death threats against BBC journalists who were trying to report the case. I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
But yeah, it was the old guard, which was, I suppose, I mean, you certainly can't say that Colin Port was sending those death threats, definitely not, but it was people who were part of that old guard, part of the old Police Officers Association, Retired Police Officers Association, and they had to bring in private security, the BBC, from London to look after journalists. So it does make you wonder, you know, this impeccable behaviour seems to be, well, very difficult to find in the police.
Well, that may be true, and I wasn't aware of that background. As I say, I was only involved since last May, where I was appointed as the mayor's representative. So I've just followed events since then and have made judgments in the context of that.
Anyway, bringing things a bit more up to date. We've just had the budget this week, but one of the announcements as part of that was announced also was questions that Prime Minister's questions just before the budget on Wednesday about academies. We're sitting in an academy school now, the City Academy, and apparently the move is, maybe Martin you can comment on this briefly before we hear the clip, is all schools to be made academies.
Indeed, and I believe that something like 80% of schools are not academies, so it's a big shake up.
Even if they don't want to. This is the bizarre thing, isn't it?
Well, also, of course, they're suggesting that parents should no longer be governors because they want people who've got business experience to be governors. And, of course, some academies have actually been encouraged to expand into other areas of activity. So one chap was running a dating agency from the same premises as the school because, of course, this is all part of the...
it's extra income, isn't it?
It's extra income and all the rest of it. But, of course, it's a huge... It's another huge... It's like the top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service. It's going to cause all kinds of... I mean, basically, schools are going to be tied up talking to lawyers to sort out what the new structure is going to be. And I actually work in an academy. I work in a primary school. And we're obviously an academy already, but the idea of all other schools in Britain are going to have to spend an awful lot of time talking about the structure instead of the learning, well, I think teachers know what they think about that.
OK, let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions again on Wednesday.
Brian Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister likes to suggest that he's the champion of localism, but today his government is seeking to gag local communities with a crass forced academies policy that stamps out local consultation and dissent. Can he explain to the vast majority of parents and residents in Brighton and Hove who recently roundly rejected academy status for two local schools why it is that their views will count for nothing in the future?
Yeah. I would argue that academy schools are true devolution because you end up with the parents, with the governors, with the head teacher having full control of the school, able to make decisions about the future of that school. And if that doesn't convince her, then I would say look at the results. If you look at primary sponsored academies, you can see that they have got better records and they're improving faster. If you look at the converter academy schools, 88% of them are rated good or outstanding. This is true devolution, making sure every head teacher is in charge of their school, providing the great education we want for our children.
Yeah, it's quite breathtaking, actually. I mean, we're actually sitting, as I understand it, in an academy school that is in special measures. Is that right? It's been in special measures? Is it not still in special measures?
No, it's not anymore, no.
Okay.
As far as I know.
I understood that it was still in special measures and hadn't made any improvements. So demonstrating the fact that an academy does not automatically make a school a better school. And I think the government's approach is just summed up. Apparently, Nikki Morgan, I read this quote today, said, and these are her words, she said, a crap academy is better than a successful local education school.
She's a Tory education minister.
Yeah. I don't know how you begin to justify a statement like that. And I know some of the headmasters of schools in South Bristol, in primary schools, who have had to really wrestle with themselves about whether they make that move over to an academy or not, because the pressures have been so great. But it seems like that decision's being taken out of their hands now.
Yeah, Martin mentioned this whole business of dropping the idea of parent governors. Now, I don't know what parents will think of that, if they will decide, well, actually, I don't want my child to go to that school because there's no parents there I can talk to who telling me what's going on and helping to run it as governors. In The Guardian today, Sally Wheel, who's their education correspondent, says plans to scrap parent governors sparked row in the school's shake-up. They're to be dropped from all school governing bodies in England in favour of professionals with the inverted commas right skills, prompting warnings from unions that parents will be sidelined in the running of schools. Until now, places have been reserved for elected parents on school governing bodies under plans outlined by Education Secretary Nikki Morgan. The white paper published on Thursday, those roles will now be abolished. New emphasis will be on skills, for example, in business or finance. Now, I mean, I experienced this a little bit because I was a director of Knightstone Housing Association. We were told we're now going over to a skills-based board and you don't have the skills, goodbye, although I was actually a residence rep. So in a way, I feel I've been getting the same sort of treatment as the parents on schools are. Now, this doesn't bode well, does it? Because you do need to have the people who are handing over their children to be educated involved in some way.
I absolutely agree. I think the most significant thing about this is it takes away the children's voice, and the schools are for the children and they can speak through their parents. And so at that level, you're taking that away. At a practical level, it's quite hard to recruit school governors. I'm not quite sure where they think all these skilled business people are going to pop up from to replace parent governors. They're already, able to become governors if they want to, generally. So as a practical measure, I can't see that it's going to work.
Martin?
Well, I think it's more Maoism, isn't it? It's kind of, they want a revolution from the top. The government is going to control all schools directly, so there'll be one line of accountability from the head teacher, each school, to Whitehall. That's it. And, of course, the head teacher in each individual case will become a little tyrant on their own quarterdeck. There'll be no appeal beyond that. And, of course, the other thing is that schools will be in competition with each other for pupils, for resources, etc. So the idea of having a fair spread of resources, making sure everybody gets a fair crack of the whip, that'll go out of the window. And, of course, the whole point of having all these schools competing with each other is that some will fail. And that's failure is part of life, and that's what's got to happen. So the idea that we should try and create a general system which gives everybody a reasonable chance of an education, a balanced education, will go out of the window. And of course the teachers who are supposedly going to be running all of this are completely opposed, but they're going to have to do it anyway.
Well, apparently there's also a crisis in recruitment of teachers.
Indeed.
As well, but launching the white paper yesterday, Nikki Morgan said rather than being an almost automatic award to staff who complete their initial teacher training in a year in the classroom, a new accreditation will be awarded when teachers have demonstrated deep subject knowledge and the ability to teach well. Most fundamentally, as in other mature professions like medicine and law, it will be for the teaching profession itself to decide when a teacher is ready to be accredited. This will ensure the decision is made by those who know best what makes a great teacher, outstanding schools and heads. So the big changes as well to the really lowering of the bar as to who is allowed to teach.
Well, indeed, and of course the temptation for a head teacher who's got to manage a certain budget is not to accredit teachers, because he can pay them less or she can pay them less. And that decision will be made by the head teacher at a head teacher level, and there'll be no appeal. So what's happened, for example, to my cousin, who teaches in East Dorset, which is one of the touriest areas of the country. She's been a primary school teacher for 30 years, but she fell out with a head teacher. The head teacher basically has rushed her, driven her out of education, after 30 years
Well, she dedicated. Could get a job somewhere else, shouldn't
she? Well, she did eventually, but she shouldn't have to be put through that, because in actual fact it's the head teacher. See, the head teachers will become entrepreneurs. They won't necessarily be teachers anymore. My dad was a head teacher of secondary schools, and he eventually retired during the last, the Tory governments of the 90s, because he said, well, in actual fact, I don't do any teaching anymore, I don't talk to children anymore, I don't talk to parents, I'm basically a business manager. And of course, that's the same thing happening with the doctors in the NHS, running their own practices.
Yeah, I mean,
so instead of worrying about health matters, they're worrying about business matters.
Deborah, I don't know if you've got any children in school, but they're not sausage factories, are they? It's not really like running a factory.
No, absolutely. I do have a daughter. She's out of school now. She's 19. But she struggled quite a lot with secondary school. Just because she was so unhappy. And the point I really want to make, and the problem with our schools goes back quite a long way, well before this government, but is that children spend most of their day in school. And if that school is an unhappy environment and the teachers aren't good teachers, they are having a wretched time. School is an awful place for them.
Well, part of this shake-up is shaking up teacher qualifications, scrapping the idea of qualified teacher status, introducing a much more open-ended system where pretty much heads can get whoever they want to teach.
Yeah, absolutely, and lowering standards and being selective about the kinds of people who are put in charge of classrooms. We've seen it with teaching assistants being given, increasingly being allowed to run classes. And
Martin, you haven't been being allowed to run classes, I hope, have you?
No. Well, I think the problem is that teaching assistants end up doing the same job as teachers, but for a fraction of the money.
Have you been put in charge? I'll put you on the spot here. Have you been put in charge of
classes? No, you're not allowed to be, not as things stand. I think the real problem here is this top-down approach to things, and also whatever happened to the Conservative value of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I notice here they're saying they're really upset that we're low down the league table, international league table. Well, I'll tell you who's the top of the league table in Europe. It's Finland. And in Finland, they do no testing at all until they're 18. They do one big exam when they're 18. It's completely comprehensive. There are no private schools. They've been abolished. And they have a complete... that they don't teach them to read and write until they're 7. So they do 4 solid years of play-based learning before they do anything to do with reading and writing. And at 18, their kids are the best in Europe. But it's a completely different setup from the one that's being proposed by the privately educated, mostly Eton-educated Tory government. Their knowledge of what goes on in inner-city schools is zero. But they're going to tell us anyway, because they love it. They love telling us what to do, don't they?
Okay, also another story. The Metro Mayor, this is on Wednesday in the Budget 2, and £1 billion investment for Greater Bristol announced in the Budget 2016. We're told by Gavin Thompson at the Bristol Post. West of England has been given the green light to press ahead with devolution, which will see a Metro Mayor elected across Bristol, South Gloucestershire, North Somerset, Bath and North East Somerset. The announcement was made by Chancellor George Osborne in his budget this afternoon. Mr Osborne said the deal would lead to close to £1 billion of investment in the region.
Yes, £1 billion over 30 years, I think, which doesn't really impress me terribly, considering the amount that some of these infrastructure projects cost. I don't think that's going to go very far, although the mayor reckons that it will bring in further investment to a much higher figure. Yes, it's not just Metro Mayor, is it? It's the whole devolution package and the devolution agenda that we're talking about.
Martin?
Well, they say
Metro Mayor.
Well, they say it's devolution. I mean, the political problem they're going to have in...
It's not devolution at all. It's concentrating power.
Yes, it's concentrating power.
In one person's hands.
Yes, it's
a bit like we've had with the mayor.
Well, indeed.
And a bit like Bath and North East Somerset just last week said, no, we don't want any of that.
No, so indeed.
75% of people in Bath and North East Somerset said no. And yet it's being imposed, this Metro Mayor.
Well, 80% of schools decided they didn't want to be academies. But who cares what they think or want?
What does this tell us about the democracy, allegedly?
Well, they are centralising power in every way, and don't forget, this is a carrot and stick approach, isn't it? If you do as we say, we will give you an extra billion.
Isn't that a bribe?
Not
it is. Carrot
well,
and
indeed,
stick.
But the political problem they're going to have in the west of England is that relatively sort of progressive Bristol with, you know, Labour, Liberal, Green control will be spatched together with Tory areas surrounding it. And ultimately that could lead to Western Supermare having to put up with George Ferguson or Marvin Rees telling him what to do, or we will have to put up with somebody from the sticks telling us what to do. Either way, people aren't going to be happy. In fact, the Tory controlled local authorities outside Bristol are dead against this, whatever George Osborne
wants. That is interesting though, isn't it, Deborah? Because if this person, if we do get this Metro Mayor and we're all voting away, it's almost certain to be a Tory. If you look at the areas where the votes are going to be taking place, it's highly likely that it'll be a Conservative Mayor, Metro Mayor.
Yeah, well, I certainly haven't looked at the figures. Obviously, Bristol has got a much higher population and there's also the question of voter turnout. So I don't know how that would pan out exactly, and it's not something I can forecast. But I think the main point is that this is being presented as devolution and localisation, whereas, as Martin says, it's exactly the opposite. It's increasing concentration at a higher level, and it's following an agenda that's George Osborne's agenda and not the agenda of people in the region.
Well, I wonder if it's someone else telling George Osborne what to do sometimes.
Well, yes.
I look at him and I think that he's just reading a script that someone has added to him. Anyway, Robert Sinclair, interim chair of the West of England Local Enterprise Partnership, wouldn't agree. He says, and he's also head of Bristol Airport, he says, business in the West of England are very supportive of this ambitious devolution deal, which transfers new strategic powers and responsibilities to local decision makers. Importantly, he says, we see a critical need for investment in major infrastructure projects to unblock congestion and drive economic growth and prosperity in this vibrant region of the UK. The deal will build on the successful joint working arrangements in place, be a real catalyst for sustainability, long-term growth, and ensure West of England can reach its full potential as the most productive economy outside London and a great place to live and work. He's essentially saying, Martin, we need someone to bang heads together.
Well, we used to have something called Avon, which was the whole area that we're now talking about. So this is effectively reinventing the wheel. It was much unloved at the time. And the idea that somebody as I understand it from having Gary Hopkins on here, the Councillor Hopkins, he was saying that in actual fact this Metro Mayor...
He's the Lib Dem leader.
Yeah, Lib Dem leader, will sit above the elected mayor of Bristol. So we'll have an elected mayor of Bristol, and then the Metro mayor will then tell the elected mayor of Bristol what to do. Now, what happens if the elected mayor of Bristol and the elected Metro mayor don't see eye to eye about something? Who's going to determine who decides what happens inside
It'll
Bristol?
It'll be pistols at dawn, no doubt.
Yeah.
Well, the other question, of course, is general scrutiny, because we've already seen that there's far less scrutiny and democracy under the mayoral system in the council, and this is just going to be exacerbated. There seems to be very little in the way of formal scrutiny from the details we've been given about this devolution deal. And this city region mayor, as they like to call her or him, is going to have free rein, really.
Have a quick look at the budget. I just wondered if you've got any thoughts, Deborah, about it. At the top of the hour, as we're going to be talking about it in part two as well, we've got a lot of money coming from the disabled and a lot of protests about this, petitions and some pretty horrific testimony of individual disabled people who it looks like are going to be under virtual house arrest, unable to move from their homes with personal independence payments going for a lot of them and the bar being lowered, and yet big handouts to corporations for corporation tax, even saying to them, well, I tell you what, you don't have to pay your tax for a few years, you just pay it a few years down the line.
Yeah, more of the same, really. And I'm completely gobsmacked about how disabled people have become the focus of so much of this government's attack, really. They're being undermined every which way they go. And we've seen the independent living funds had their funding removed. We've seen people subjected to all sorts of testing for their employment support allowance, and now we've got this. And I don't really understand how they can do this.
You're just looking at the figures in the mirror. We're talking about nearly 300,000 disabled people being affected by the cuts in PIP, personal independent payments benefits, and those will use on average around about £4,100 a year each.
Sorry, what?
There's about 300,000 disabled people will be losing about 4,100.
Yeah, which, I mean, and there's no recognition quite often that it's actually more expensive to live as a disabled person. It's more expensive for lots of reasons, but and it's also much more difficult to find work. There are shocking employment rates. So they are really being forced into poverty.
We've also had, Martin, several disabled charities have decided to sack various Conservative MPs for voting for the changes to disabled benefits, including Zach Goldsmith, who's running for Mayor of London.
Well, good for them is all I can say to that. The other thing that absolutely sickens me about this, we're supposedly having an austerity policy because we've got to get the deficit down by 2020. Although, of course, he did promise to get the deficit down during the last Parliament, but changed his mind because there was going to be an election. Now, in that circumstance, is there any case whatsoever for cutting tax rates for the wealthiest, which is what they've done in this budget? So at the same time as saying, we've got to cut, there's no money for disabled people, sorry, you've got to have to lose four grand a year each. But at the same time, for wealthy people, I'm afraid we're going to reduce your tax take. And also, of course, they've bottled out of changing the rules about pensions, so they get tax relief on their pensions. Now, there's no real case for top-level earners to have tax relief on their pensions, and it could easily have been clawed back. But of course, Osborne caved in to pressure from the City of London and the Tory donors, and of all the pain is going to the bottom and all the jam is going to the top. But where is the whole case of we're all in this together? If we're about reducing the deficit more than anything else, that's actually an economic illiteracy, but never mind. If we are about reducing the deficit, what case is there for tax cuts at the top? In the 1950s, the top rate of tax in Britain and the United States of America was 96%, and that was a time when the capitalist economy, both in the US and Britain, worked a lot better than it does today. What has happened in the interim is that the people at the top have basically bamboozled the people at the bottom into believing that they can have everything they want and all of the pain has to be taken by the people the most vulnerable in the society. Ultimately, this will snap, and it will snap because there isn't sufficient demand in the economy because wages are being forced
down. Martin, these are tough questions you're putting here, tough points you're putting. Why did we get so little of this on Wednesday in the mainstream media coverage of the budget?
Because everybody's more interested in things like, is there going to be a sugar tax? Because they can understand that. If you start talking about macroeconomics and the fact that you shouldn't really cut, if, for example, the economy starts to weaken, you want the deficit to increase because otherwise the economy falls down the drain. What George Osborne did was as he started trying to force the economy into austerity during the first part of the last Parliament, and the economy started to splutter. So at that point, he took his foot off the brake and allowed the economy to grow, which increased the deficit. And those two things were actually linked. The deficit not going down and the economy picking up are related things. I used to teach A-level economics. The two things are directly related. If you try and cut too far, too fast, you crash the economy. Now, he's actually got a sense of survival.
Deborah,
so he's not doing that.
Deborah, one of the things that George Osborne said in his speech on Wednesday, the budget speech, was that by the end of this Parliament, he's going to return a deficit to a surplus. I mean, the only trouble is, of course, he said that way back in 2010, the same thing, and every time it seems to shift. The time that he's actually going to turn the surplus is another 4 or 5 years in the future.
Of course, and I would totally agree with Martin anyway, it's not necessarily a desirable goal in the first place, and we need to shift our thinking back. The Tories managed to put up a very good story about how this was somehow an analogy with domestic finances and you needed to balance your outgoings and incomings as if it was that simple.
Well, explain why it's not, because it's common sense, surely. You've got to balance the books.
Well, it's not common sense because capitalism, actually, interestingly enough, is based on this principle of investment. And what you need to do is you borrow money to invest in things. And I very much believe in that you need to invest in people and that therefore you need to sometimes borrow money in order to do that.
Well, it's a big bit of investment quite possibly happening right on your doorstep, isn't there, the arena. Do you think that's a wise way to be, wise place for us to be investing our money?
Oh, wow, the arena, which dominates my life. I don't really...
Does it?
Well, it does, unfortunately, because it's the major issue for local people, and so I've had to take that on. I haven't really got a strong opinion myself about the arena. A lot of people welcome it and feel like it will be a boon to the area. It's really been more about, for me, it's been about the planning around the arena and what are the implications for people, for local people around having the arena on their doorstep.
Yes, just on the Metro Mayor story we were doing a bit earlier, I've noticed something on the Bristol Post just popped up today, which is the Labour leader of South Gloucestershire Council saying that there should be a referendum. Now, I'm a little bit shocked to hear that there may have not been a referendum. Can they just impose this kind of thing on us?
They certainly can, and there's discussion about whether a referendum should be called at the same time as the EU referendum. In Bristol, there's a discussion going on about that, but nobody really actually thinks that this will happen. And there's been no consultation with councillors over this devolution deal. We've had virtually no information, even though it's been requested. So even at that level, in this run-up, there's been complete secrecy about the deal. So to some extent, putting it out to a referendum is it's all a bit too late
the day. Well, if they did do a referendum, I wonder if they would take all the ballot boxes down to Bristol City Football Club, and like they did during the mayor referendum we originally had, and leave them overnight under the guard of private security of Bristol City Football Club with no CCTV coverage or anything like that of the ballot boxes, which just didn't seem to me to be a very professional way to conduct a democratic referendum or an election or anything like that. Martin, on the subject of the Metro Mayor, do you any idea? What do you think it's going to happen or not?
Well, if you think about it, if they did have a referendum across the region, which was proposed to have this Metro Mayor, what happens if Bristol votes against and everybody else votes for? It's a bit like the EU referendum. What if Scotland votes to stay in the EU and England votes to leave? What if Wales and... what will happen in Northern Ireland with the EU referendum, very likely, is that the Nationalists will vote to stay in the EU and the Protestants will vote to leave. They don't think about these kind of things in Farage land, do they?
Okay, another story. Now, Labour are neck and neck with the Tories, would you believe? I didn't hear much coverage of this story during the week. In a poll for the first time since Jeremy Corbyn became leader, the ICM phone poll is good news for Labour. This is in The Independent on Monday, which we're going to have to wave goodbye to the Independent newspaper very soon. I think it's his last week of editions. I mean, in Turkey, what happens is the police come in and shut down newspapers, but over here, you just get the big corporations pulling all their advertising, and then the newspaper just collapses in a great big heap. That's what's happened, I think, with the Independent. But anyway, Labour has drawn level with the Conservatives in an opinion poll for the first time since the 2015 general election. Jeremy Corbyn's party was up 4 points compared to last month in ICM's monthly phone poll, 36%, while the Conservatives were down 3 to 36%. Does that surprise you, Deborah?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. And the reason is that Labour have now gone over to a position of anti-austerity. They spent a long time agreeing with the Conservative government, the coalition government beforehand, and the Greens actually held the torch for this idea of anti-austerity and the SNP and played Cymru through the election, and Jeremy Corbyn was able to pick it up afterwards, and that's why Labour are seeing an improvement in their support.
I think it's more to do with, I mean, I hate to say this, it's more to do with the Conservatives losing support. I think people are beginning to realise that they don't know what they're doing. I mean, they're very much...
Well, they do know what they're doing. Oh, no, they're looking after number one.
Well, yes, but they don't know what they're doing in terms of managing the ship of state, as it were. One of the things that's most interesting about the last election is that if 3,000 people who voted Green in 10 marginal constituencies had voted Labour under our ridiculous first-past-the-post system, the Tories would have been denied a majority, and then we would have had to have a coalition of some kind, probably a UKIP. Well, it wouldn't have been a UKIP coalition because they only got one elected under the system. But in other words, the whole system is stupid. We need PR, we need constitutional reform, we need probably a written constitution. But we're probably going to get that in the end as a result of all the shenanigans around Brexit.
Just one, I mean, we don't really have time to comment on it, but £40 million, the amount of money which is not claimed in benefits in Bristol each year. The number of people who do not claim or receive less than they're entitled is nearly 13,000 people in Bristol. So go out and claim, like I've just had to redo my housing benefit anyway. Thanks very much, Deborah Joffe from the Greens, for joining us. We'll be back after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6. A suspect in the Paris terror attacks has been captured alive during an operation in Belgium. The country's migration ministers posted a message on Twitter that simply says, "We got him." A number of shots were heard during a raid in the Molenbeek area of Brussels earlier. There are reports Salah Abdeslam was wounded.